standing around doing nothing interesting or profitable. They stayed there interminably, only occasionally taking a step forward. Honestly, was it any wonder their clan chief had finally begged Raoul's father for the guidance and support of the Silent Paws? At last they funneled through a relatively tiny opening in the wall of the spire, along with a column of similarly placid humanity, and took their turn wasting even more time by talking to armed humans who were not even so important as to have large hats. And only after all of that indecipherable human ritual was complete to their satisfaction did they enter Havel Landing. Raoul reminded himself that cats were eternally patient, and that he would not simply explode if he did not fling himself from Little Mouse's arms and go exploring. Which was not to say that he could not do so if he wished, because cats were also their own masters. He decided that his patience was practically legendary, which was fortunate for Little Mouse, or Raoul would already have taken care of this problem, or mystery, or whatever it was, while she was still milling about in the line to talk to the armed humans at the entrance to Havel Landing, thus robbing her of the glory of success. Though, now that he thought about it, he was the most important member of the party. Any glory gained was rightfully his in any case. He decided to tolerate the situation for the present, but if the humans became unmanageable, he might have to take steps, and who could blame him? Not even his father would assert that it was practical to manage 5 humans. It was a well-known fact that humans became more addled than usual when running in herds. Havel Landing was fascinating. For one thing, the ceiling was only half the height of the other Havels he'd seen. It was still far above even Little Mouse's head, but the more enclosed space reminded him of the ducts and ventilation tunnels that were traditionally the territory of his people. And it was thick with humanity. Havel Morning was considered to be a well-populated Havel, but Havel Landing absolutely teemed with people by comparison. Hundreds and hundreds of them were coming and going through the hole in the spire wall. Dozens of humans who were selling trinkets and keepsakes, all of which Little Mouse would say were absolute necessities for a human, were lined up along the walls in neatly arranged stalls, and this wasn't even the market area. Voices filled the air, so many of them that it was impossible to pick out a specific conversation. Taken as a whole, the voices created a low murmur that sounded a bit like the sighing of air through a junction point in the vents. Scents were thick, too. Foul smells that always came with humanity. Savory smells of various foods, and absolutely fascinating scents he could not identify. "Goodness," Human Gwendolyn was saying, "have you ever seen so many people coming and going?" "It would be a lovely setting for slipping an enemy agent into the spire," Human Benedict agreed. Human Folly was apparently frightened of something, though she was in no danger that Raoul could see. Her heart beat very quickly, and she stank of nerves strung tight. She kept her eyes on the floor and stayed within inches of the senior male of the group, Master Ferris. The older man's eyes were almost closed, as if he wanted an observer to think he was nearly sleeping. But Raoul could see them flicking around in an almost feline fashion, taking in the sights just as he was. "Master Ferris?" Human Gwendolyn asked. "Where should we go, sir?"
"Hm?"
Ferris said.
"What's that?" "Lodging, perhaps?"
Little Mouse suggested.
"Ah, excellent, yes."
He glanced back at Human Benedict.
"Young man, do you know of a decent inn?"
"I believe there are a great many of them in the Havel, but I stayed at the guardhouse while I was here," Human Benedict said, in an apologetic tone. "I do know that we should be able to hire a runner who can assist us." Human Gwendolyn frowned.
"Should we not stay there as well? This is an official inquisition for the Spyrarch, after all." "We can't make it official, and we can't stay at the guardhouse," Little Mouse said. "If there is a traitor amongst the guard, and we march in and announce our intentions, we might as well blow trumpets everywhere we go."
Quite right,
Master Ferris said.
Quite right. A runner, then?
Human Gwendolyn seemed to take that as a command. She nodded and strode off through the crowd. Raoul waited with infinite patience. There were many things to see and smell.
One human vendor had a great many little creatures in little cages. Some of them had wings, and some scales, and some fur. Raoul managed to sort out scents to their owners and study them thoughtfully. Then a gentle stir and shift in the direction of the ventilated air announced the arrival of afternoon, as the sun began to warm the other side of the spire, and brought with it a deliriously savory scent of cooking meat.
Raoul whipped his head to one side to stare in the direction from which the scent came, and noted, as he did, that Human Benedict had wit enough to smell it too, and was showing exactly the same interest. The human's stomach made growling, grumbling sounds. Human Gwendolyn returned shortly, in the company of a rather scrawny little human kit. The little human's hair was a mess, its face was dirty, its clothing ragged, and Raoul, who found humans drearily like one another most of the time, could not tell whether the apparent runner was male or female.
"This is Grady," Human Gwendolyn announced. "He has graciously consented to guide us to an inn."
"Aye, aye," said the little human. "Just come with me, ladies and gents, and we'll get you squared away with a clean bed and a hot meal."
"Good, good," said the oldest human. "Proceed."
"Yes, sir," said the little human. "Right this way."
They followed the little human from the gallery that led to the shipyard and into a side tunnel, where he produced a medium-sized lumen crystal and made everyone utterly blind to anything happening more than a few paces away. Humans were inconsiderate that way. Raoul could see perfectly well, after all. It was hardly his fault if humans couldn't tell the difference between mere dimness and true darkness. Which was ironic, because they were, as a whole, among the dimmest creatures he knew. They walked a short way through the side tunnel, and then exited into a long, narrow street, where the human buildings crowded in close on every side, and thrust up from the floor all the way to the ceiling in many cases. But the building heights were uneven and jagged overall, like so many broken teeth. The street was only dimly lit, and there were considerably fewer humans walking along it than they had seen near the shipyard. Raoul found that inconsistent. The presence of danger brushed along his fur as the little human led Little Mouse and her companions down the street, and Raoul found himself gathering and releasing his muscles. He could not pinpoint any particular threat, and yet Little Mouse, wise enough to look to a cat for guidance, noticed Raoul's reaction almost immediately. Her own posture became tenser, her eyes flicking around, searching for any threat just as Raoul did. Suddenly, Raoul heard soft footfalls behind them, and he turned his ears quickly to listen in that direction.
"Little Mouse,"
he said quietly.
"We are being hunted. Behind us."
She looked down at him but did not swivel her head to look over her shoulder toward their pursuers. Excellent. Such a gesture would have alerted the hunters to the fact that their prey had sensed them. Little Mouse was so clever, for a human, of course.
"Benedict,"
Little Mouse said quietly.
"Raoul thinks someone is following us."
Human Benedict frowned at her but did not ask questions. Instead, Raoul saw his nostrils flare, and he began to use his eyes, looking around him, though he did not turn his head.
"Damn,"
Human Benedict said a moment later. He took a step forward, drawing even with Master Ferris, and tapped Human Gwendolyn on the shoulder. She turned to look up at him, but didn't stop walking. Human Benedict leaned down to speak quietly to her.
"Cuz, I'm afraid we've been marked."
Human Gwendolyn frowned.
"Marked?"
She looked down at herself.
"Did someone put something on my dress?"
Human Benedict let out a breath through his teeth. Marked, Kaz, as prey. We're being paced and followed.
By whom?
Footpads, most likely, Human Benedict replied. There are several gangs that operate in Habble Landing. Human Gwendolyn narrowed her eyes.
I see. And which person has marked us specifically?
To your left, Human Benedict said, about 10 feet behind us. Dark brown coat, black hair, about 20. He's keeping track of us by watching our reflections in windows as we pass them. And there's another one, ahead of us, on the right, in that slouchy hat.
I see,
she replied.
What is the usual course of action for dealing with such things?
Avoid them.
We've already failed at that,
Human Gwendolyn said, her tone irritated.
What else?
Human Benedict sounded a bit flustered. Cuz, how should I know? I've never been marked by footpads before. She considered that and nodded.
I see.
Then, without hesitating for more than the time it took to take a step, Human Gwendolyn turned, raised her gauntlet, and discharged it. An almost invisible bolt of force and heat howled through the air and slammed into the stone wall of a building's front side, not 2 feet from the head of the footpad pacing them from behind. The light made Raoul duck his head to shield his eyes, and the force of the blast threw chips of stone from the wall, sending them skittering around the street. The footpad, and perhaps a dozen other humans who happened to be nearby, let out a shriek and flinched back, staring at the smoking, scorched gouge in the stone. He lost his balance and fell to the ground and onto his rear. The entire street, in fact, froze in its tracks, everyone staring at little Human Gwendolyn. She stepped toward the footpad, her gauntlet's crystal still glowing in her palm, and raised her voice to a pitch and volume that would carry it to the entire street. She pointed the forefinger of her right hand at the stunned footpad and said, her voice hard,
"You!"
The man just stared at her.
"Run home!"
Human Gwendolyn said,
"Do it now, and inform your masters that we are not prey."
Her words echoed around the stone building fronts for a few seconds. Then the footpad's mouth twitched a couple of times. He gave a jerking, frantic nod, scrambled to his feet, and dashed away down the street and out of sight. Raoul turned his eyes back to Human Gwendolyn, impressed. That was precisely how one should deal with a would-be predator. Human Gwendolyn's instincts and response had been practically non-incompetent. "Maker of the path," Human Benedict swore beneath his breath. "Cuz, you just discharged a gauntlet on a crowded street."
"And stopped us from being attacked by thugs,"
Human Gwendolyn replied.
"No one was hurt. Honestly, cuz, we have no time for this sort of nonsense."
She took a step forward and knelt down to stare in the eye the little human who had led them there.
"Grady,"
she said in a sweet tone,
"why did you bring us here to be attacked?"
"I didn't,"
the little human said, his face bloodless.
"I wouldn't. I won't, miss."
"You just happened to bring us down a crowded chute full of men seeking targets to mug. Is that what you want me to believe?"
The little human swallowed. Then he said,
"I know another inn, miss, right by the gallery out in the open. I could take you there if it pleases you."
"Fool me once, shame on you,"
Gwendolyn said.
"Fool me twice, and I may feel inclined to blast you purely on principle."
The little human stared at her, agog.
"Boo!"
Gwendolyn shouted and stamped her foot. Grady turned and sprinted off. "Are you certain you don't want to blast the ground at his feet as he runs away?" Benedict asked, his voice dry.
"Don't be tiresome, Benny,"
Gwendolyn replied.
"If we can't trust one runner, we can't trust any of them. There's no guarantee that the next time it might not be Auroran agents instead of simple thieves waiting for us. Present me with options."
Benedict frowned for a moment and then shrugged. "There's one place we can go where I feel certain we can at least get honest guidance, if nothing else."
"Excellent," Gwendolyn said. "Let us proceed."
"This way," Benedict said, and they started walking again. After a moment or two, Human Benedict turned to look directly at Raoul.
"Thank you," he said.
Raoul yawned, feeling rather pleased with himself for having saved his humans from footpads, and said,
"It is what I do."
Chapter 25. Monastery of the Way. Havel Landing. Bridget walked carefully through the cramped passages of Havel Landing, trying to pay attention to any other sources of potential danger. But she felt as if she'd been sent to the store without anyone telling her what she was supposed to buy.
What would danger look like?
She supposed that if it was overt and obvious, just anyone could see it coming, but she had no idea of what an ambush might resemble before it actually began to happen. She saw no one in a great black cape, or twirling a waxed moustache, which all the villains in the theatre seemed to have, though she supposed true villains would rarely do one the courtesy of identifying themselves and declaring their intentions in a forthright manner.
It was one of the things that made them villains, after all.
She kept one eye on Raoul constantly. She would never admit it to the little bully aloud, but he probably had a much better idea than she of what might prove a threat. He was already even more insufferably pleased with himself than usual today, having warned them of the footpads. If she admitted it to him, he would never let her forget it. Raoul, for his part, looked and sniffed and flicked his ears this way and that, taking in all the sights and sounds of the busy, even maniacally industrious Havel. The crowded labyrinth of vendor stalls and counters near the airship docks had been only a foretaste of the Havel proper. There were more shops in operation in one quadrant of Landing than in the entirety of Havel Morning. And they had divided their vertical space in half, so that there was a whole second level above them, presumably filled with even more enterprise. Entire lengths of cramped street were dedicated to specific crafts and businesses. There was a street of tinkers and smiths, the air hot and filled with the sound of metal on metal. There was an entire street of papermakers, the smell of their labours so appalling that Raoul buried his nose beneath Bridget's arm until they were past. There was a street of vatteries next to the street of tanners, next to the dye-makers, and absolutely everyone seemed to be in a great hurry, passing their slower-stepping group with grumbles and dire glares. The people were just as dazzling in variety. She'd always assumed that Havel Morning was the most cosmopolitan Havel of the Spire, the absolute hub of Albion culture. But though visitors weren't precisely unheard of there was simply no comparison to be made. In the space of 10 minutes, she spotted half a dozen different groups of foreigners moving through the streets of Landing. She saw a group of ruddy-cheeked Olympians in their traditional green and gold garb, most of them wearing the device of their home spire's laurel wreath upon their breasts or pendants or rings. Not 5 steps later, a pair of women with the golden brown skin marking them as Nephesians strolled by wearing long sweeping skirts in half a dozen fine, pattern-slashed layers of different colours. They were followed by a tall, warrior-born man with the nearly black skin and ice-blue eyes of an Atlantean, wearing an airship captain's coat of indigo, and not long after that she spotted a crew of rather small, lean, worn-looking men and women, whose faces were marked with the fine, swirling ritual scars of pikers.
"Is this your first time out of Havel Morning, Miss Darquin?" Benedict asked her.
Bridget jerked her eyes away from the pikers rather guiltily.
"Is it so obvious?"
"Totally understandable," he said. "After all,
Something like 70% of the residents of Spire Albion never leave their home Habbles at all.
I should think it would reduce one's chances of being preyed upon by footpaths, she observed.
Benedict grinned. Oh, of course. Crews like that never pick on anyone from their home Habble. Too easily identified to the authorities, and their leaders would never allow it.
Leaders? Bridget asked. They aren't just, like, packs of marauding vent rats.
Naturally not, Benedict said. Far too messy and chaotic, and therefore easily stopped. Everything they do has to be coordinated and carefully organized.
Organized robbery?
Among other things, yes, Benedict said. Smuggling, the sale of dangerous intoxicants, trafficking in weapons, in medicines, in flesh. His eyes darkened slightly. All controlled and precisely applied by the guilds. Bridget blinked.
The guilds? Like the Vatterists' Guild?
I doubt it's much like the Vatterists' Guild in Habble Morning, Benedict replied. All of the guilds are in competition here, and most of them engage in one kind of shady activity or another. Some are worse than others, but as a rule, if someone gets his head broken in Habble Landing, it was because one of the guilds decided it needed to be done.
It would seem to be a great deal of trouble to manage a group of men who would do such things,
Bridget noted. Indeed it is.
Wouldn't it be simpler for them to just do honest work?
Benedict showed his teeth. Probably. But there will always be those who seem to think that simply taking what they need through strength is easier and more enjoyable than working to create it. Certainly it leaves them more leisure time.
I don't understand,
Bridget said.
Why would guilds that behave this way be permitted to exist?
Any number of reasons, Benedict said. If there is a law, someone will work to break it. That's human nature. The guilds have a certain code of conduct to which they adhere that makes them a somewhat less appalling proposition than independent criminal activity. They are the devil we know. He pursed his lips, and they are extremely powerful.
Not more powerful than the guard, surely.
More focused than the guard, Benedict said. Much harder to find than the guard. And, of course, they aren't burdened by the restrictions of Spire law. Atop that, they also control a number of legitimate businesses, and through their influence can significantly alter Habble politics. They command a combination of fear, respect, money, and professional craft that makes conflict with them a difficult and dangerous proposition. Bridget frowned, thinking about that.
Then, pardon me if my understanding falls short, but did not Gwendolyn just issue a rather blatant public command to these powerful and dangerous men?
Yes, Benedict said placidly. Yes, she did.
Oh, dear,
Bridget said.
That seems less than ideal.
Benedict shrugged, his feline eyes constantly sweeping the streets as they walked. Perhaps they'll respect it as a show of strength. Men like that tend to refrain from unprofitable enterprises, such as preying upon victims who can fight back, and the Lancasters can certainly do that. They turned down a final cramped street, and as they did, Bridget could actually see the tension go out of Benedict's lean frame, and his face relaxed into a smile.
"What just happened?"
Bridget asked. "This is safe territory. We're close now," Benedict said. "The guilds won't operate in this portion of the Habble."
"Why not?"
"They've been taught that it is more trouble than it's worth," Benedict said. They passed through a last bit of street crammed with buildings, and suddenly emerged from the warren into the open space of a standard height Habble ceiling stretching out 50 feet overhead. The rest of the Habbel's buildings simply ended, the twin levels connected by a heavy deck and several large wooden stairways, as if their designers had simply forgotten to carry the conversion of the original space beyond the point they had just passed. Before them stood a solid wall of masonry, 10 feet high, set with a single heavy gate of bronze-bound wooden beams. In front of the gate sat a man in a rather odd-looking saffron robe, the material loose-fitting around the upper arms, but bound in by wraps on his forearms. His pale head was shaved, entirely bald, and he sat with his eyes closed, his legs crossed, and his palms resting lightly on his knees. A simple rod of copper-clad metal, about 3 feet long, rested on the floor beside his right hand.
"Oh," Bridget said, "is that a monk of the way?"
Raoul stirred in her arms and looked up at the man, the cat's ears focused forward and his tail twitching with interest.
"Oh, I can't do this," Master Ferris said. "Sir Benedict, would you mind?"
"Of course, sir," Benedict said. He raised his voice a little and said, "This is Brother Vincent. He has gate duty because his handwriting is terrible."
Brother Vincent smiled without opening his eyes.
"Sir Benedict, have you come to teach or to learn?"
"Shall we find out together, brother?" Benedict asked. Brother Vincent smiled and did not open his eyes. Benedict promptly unbuckled his sword belt and stripped off his gauntlet. He held them out to Bridget and asked,
"Do you mind?"
She blinked and then assured him,
"Not at all."
It took a bit of juggling to hold Benedict's weapons and Raoul at the same time, but she managed.
"Thank you, miss," Benedict said.
Then he turned and began stalking toward Brother Vincent on cat-quiet feet.
"What is happening here, precisely?"
Gwendolen asked Master Ferris.
"Tradition," Ferris replied, watching Benedict with bright eyes.
She frowned.
"Meaning what, precisely?"
"Isn't it traditional for a Lancaster to know something about tradition?"
Master Ferris asked acerbically. Folly gave a little curtsy to no one in particular, and then told her jar of crystals,
"The monks take their guardianship of the temple very seriously. They won't allow anyone to enter casually. One must prove to the monks that his desire to enter is sincere."
Gwendolen lifted one delicate eyebrow.
"And how does one..."
Silent as darkness itself, Benedict sprang upon Brother Vincent.
"Oh,"
Gwendolen said,
"I see."
Bridget had never seen the warrior-born move so quickly, but somehow the monk was already on his feet, and the two men met in a flurry of blows and counter-blows that made Bridget's heart skip several beats. She could barely see what they were doing, they moved so quickly, and it was laughable to think that she might be able to anticipate what might happen next. By comparison, her own knowledge of unarmed fighting was, she could see now, a pebble beside a spire. And then something terribly complex and lightning quick happened, and Benedict wound up with his face pressed against the spire-stone floor, while Brother Vincent held one of the warrior-born's arms straight out and up behind him at what seemed an extremely uncomfortable angle. The monk stood over him with one foot braced against his back until Benedict grimaced and slapped the floor twice. Brother Vincent obligingly released his arm, and the younger man lay quietly for a moment before gathering himself and rising to his feet. He rolled his shoulder several times, wincing.
"What was that?"
"It would seem," Brother Vincent said, "that you have come to learn, young knight."
"I was fairly sure of that 5 minutes ago. You never showed me that combination."
"Didn't I?" Brother Vincent asked, smiling. "Goodness, such an oversight. But I'm sure I haven't forgotten to show you anything else." "I'm sure you didn't forget, brother," Benedict replied, his tone wry. "I think you just want me to come visit more often." Brother Vincent smiled and clasped Benedict's shoulder with one hand for a moment.
It took time to soften your skull enough for ideas to slip in, but you proved a good student eventually. It is good to see you, son.
Benedict smiled, and the two exchanged a bow.
Brother, we've come to the temple for help.
Vincent's dark eyes became troubled. You know that we do not involve ourselves in politics, Sir Benedict.
Nor would I ask you to do so, Benedict said. Perhaps you could spare a cup of tea and a few moments of conversation.
Brother Vincent studied Benedict's face for a moment before his gaze turned to take in the young man's companions.
Bridget felt slightly uncomfortable beneath that gaze. It seemed as though the man could see a great deal more of her than he had any right to. Brother Vincent's stare lingered on Master Ferris the longest, and he sighed.
And then the rumours are true. War again.
And the walls have ears, Benedict said.
Of course,
Vincent said.
I'll get someone to cover my post. Do bring your companions inside.
Benedict nodded and beckoned to the rest of them. Bridget walked over to him and passed his weaponry back.
That was amazing, she said.
That was typical, Benedict said, smiling. Amazing would have been if I'd beaten him.
How do you know him?
He was my mentor when I first came, several years ago, Benedict said. I was considering joining the monks at the time.
Gwendolyn made a slight sniffing sound.
Ridiculous, Benny. You'd look wretched in saffron.
It's not my best colour, Benedict said gravely, nodding.
He mostly wore purple back then,
Brother Vincent said cheerfully.
Purple?
Bridget asked. Bruises, Benedict clarified, smiling. I was the kind of student who sometimes had difficulty listening.
A teacher can always find other paths, Vincent said. Ladies and gentlemen, won't you please come inside? Welcome to the Temple of the Way.
Chapter 26. Spire Albion, Hebble Landing, Temple of the Way. Gwendolyn watched Bridget hand her cousin's weaponry back to him, and carefully did not smirk.
For goodness sake, Gwen had been standing just as close to him, and with empty arms as well, and yet Benny had turned to the girl with the cat almost instinctively when he began to disarm himself.
Benedict had expressed to Gwen his determination to avoid entanglements with a wife in no uncertain terms on any number of occasions. He had even been something very nearly rude to Mother when she had pressed one too many partners upon him at a dance 2 years ago. It was not as though there were no young ladies interested in him. Oh, granted, none of the highest tier of eligible ladies would have considered a union with a young warrior born, even if he'd been a full member of House Lancaster. Well, perhaps if he'd been the heir, she supposed. But the ladies of the lesser houses could very well better their position through a union with Benedict. There was also, she thought, always that sort of person who would gladly seek a tryst with one of the warrior-born simply for the thrill of something so outré.
Benedict was, of course, a fine-looking young man. He had been pursued by any number of young, or youngish, widows when he came of age, but he had ignored them all with steady, polite reserve. Now he spoke quietly with Bridget and the Wayist monk, and Gwendolyn felt immensely pleased for him. She had known Bridget long enough to feel certain that she had no designs on Benedict for the sake of his endowments, monetary or otherwise. And while Bridget seemed to have very little in the way of social graces, such things could be learned. Anyway, courage and integrity were more important, and the girl had those in excess. The name of Targwyn still carried weight in some corners of the Hebble, too. Mother could be convinced to bless such a union. Of course, Benedict would be sure to make a hash of things if left to his own devices. Thank goodness he had someone to smooth the way for him. When the time was right, naturally. Gwendolyn smiled in satisfaction and followed the monk into the temple with the rest of her group.
She was entirely unprepared for what she found in the interior of the temple. She had expected a rather simple arrangement, and indeed it was, in the extreme. But the monks had transformed the courtyard behind the temple's heavy gate into a garden so lush and thick that even those in her family's estates simply could not compare. Every square foot that could be spared, she saw, had been devoted to planters of masonry filled with rich black earth transported painstakingly from the surface. Each planter supported a fine net of silken threads above it, spangled with small lumen crystals that glowed like a thousand stars, bathing the whole of the courtyard in rich silver radiance. Beneath the woven nets of light grew fruit trees, grapevines, rows of vegetables and grains, as well as flowers, small trees, ferns, and leafy bushes she could not identify. Foodstuffs growing from the filthy soil of the surface, rather than in a proper water garden treated with nutrient-bearing vat sand. The very thought was somewhat nauseating. Why do such a thing? The smell of the place was simply shocking. It filled the air with a riot of scents, sharp and pungent, rotten and sweet, and above all, very, very alive. The air itself seemed different, thick and swollen with moisture. The impression of the whole was that of rampant life, growing as wild as the deadly green hell covering the surface of the world, and she felt her heart speed up in an immediate irrational reaction of instinctive fear. Her rational mind told her that clearly there was no danger here. Any number of monks were moving quietly through the plants in their saffron garb, trimming and tending and weeding. Insects buzzed through the air, many of them striped with yellow and black. Bees? Goodness, she hadn't known anyone had been able to successfully transplant a colony to Spire Albion. As far as she knew, only the pikers had managed to successfully manage beehives, and their near monopoly of the honey and mead market provided the cornerstone for their economy. Well, if this garden could support something as fragile as bees, surely the place couldn't be all that threatening, regardless of how nightmarish it might look. She took a breath and steadied herself, and pressed forward through the vegetation, following her cousin and brother Vincent. There must have been 200 feet of the bizarre gardens between the gate and the temple proper, which rose up to a height of 4 stories and was built of excellent masonry. The building looked nearly as square and as solid and as fixed as if it had been made of spire stone by the builders themselves. Despite its height, it managed to appear squat and thick, as if determined to resist the sheer idea of any assault, much less the actual attack that might spring from such a notion. 2 more of the monks, armed as Brother Vincent had been, stood at the main doors of the temple and watched in stoic silence as Gwendolyn's group followed their guide within. Gwen expected the inside of the temple to match its stony exterior, but to her surprise she found that it was warmly lit and decorated with paintings and banners bearing proverbs in wayist script. Some of the paintings, though they depicted iconic figures of the wayist faith, had been masterfully produced. In their own way, they were a match for the collection they'd seen in the Spire Arch's manor. The floor was made of stone blocks, but was painted a deep green colour, except for a brown path that wavered back and forth down the hallway. So many feet had walked upon the painted path that in its centre the paint had worn away, and the stone itself had been worn down along with it. With the others, Gwen found herself naturally following the depression along the hallway, the soles of her feet an inch below the proper level of the floor. "The meal room?" Benedict asked. "It seems simplest," Brother Vincent said. The monk looked over his shoulder and smiled at Gwen. "You seem surprised, miss. It's very lovely in here, really," Gwen found herself replying. "It's not at all like it appears to be on the outside."
"Is anything?"
asked Brother Vincent with a small smile.
"Here we go," Benedict said beneath his breath. Gwen arched an eyebrow at her cousin and turned back to Brother Vincent.
"Wouldn't it be faster to walk in straight lines rather than wandering back and forth like this? This way does not seem sensible."
The monk's smile widened.
"Did anyone forbid you to do so?"
"Well, no," Gwen said.
"Why aren't you walking the way you believe to be sensible, then?"
Gwen blinked. "Well, it was obviously the way everyone walks here, I suppose.
Did you wish to avoid offending our sensibilities?"
"No, not exactly,"
Gwen said.
It seemed the proper thing to do."
Brother Vincent nodded.
"Why?"
"Because, well, look at it. The stones are all worn down where everyone has walked."
"Do you feel you should walk the same path because so many have walked it before you came, miss?"
Gwen glanced at Benedict, but her cousin only looked back at her in silence, apparently interested in her answer.
"No, of course not. Except, yes, in a way. I hadn't really given it any thought."
"Few do."
Brother Vincent bowed his head and turned to continue leading them down the hallway, and Gwen had the sudden impression, from his body language, that he was a teacher who had just concluded a lesson. She felt her back stiffen slightly.
"Brother Vincent,"
she said, in what she felt must be a tempered yet iron tone.
"Are you trying to trick me into becoming a weighist?"
She couldn't see his face, but from where she stood she could see his cheeks round out as he smiled.
"In the void there is no distinction of east and west."
Gwen blinked slightly at that.
"I know all of those words, and yet when strung together like that I have no idea what they mean."
The monk nodded.
"Perhaps you are choosing not to hear them."
Gwen sighed in exasperation.
"Benedict!"
Her cousin turned to walk backward for a few paces and smiled.
"He's like that, cuz. I don't know what he means either. It's his way."
The monk carefully did not turn, and Gwen suddenly felt that the man might be laughing at her, so she sniffed once, lifted her chin firmly, and started walking in a straight line down the hall, weighist custom be damned. She tripped on the irregular surface a few seconds later, and all but fell. After that she lowered her chin enough to make sure she could watch where she put her feet.
"Pardon me, brother," Master Ferris said a moment later, "but might I trouble you to show us the collection, if it isn't too much trouble? My apprentice has never seen it."
Brother Vincent's face lit up as if the etherealist had just offered to cook him a fine meal.
"Of course, sir. It's on the way, after all."
Master Ferris beamed.
"Excellent. Attend, Folly."
"Yes, master,"
the apprentice said.
"Collection?"
Gwen said.
"What collection?"
Vincent's eyes gleamed. He stopped at a very large, very heavy door and opened it with a gentle push of his hand. The enormous thing swung open wide, silently and smoothly, to reveal an immense chamber beyond.
"Ladies and gentlemen," he said in a quiet, vibrant tone, "the great library of Spire Albion."
Gwen felt her eyes widen. The great library was huge. It must have taken up 3/4 of the space of the entire temple all by itself. The ground floor was filled with shelving and work tables, and every inch of shelf space was crammed with books, books of every size and shape and color. Why, the collection here beggared the one at her academy. That had been a library of nearly 3,000 volumes, and it wouldn't have taken up 1/10 of the space of the ground floor of the library. And there were 3 tiers of shelves circling the outer wall of the library above the ground floor, each accessed by balconies and multiple series of staircases. More monks moved around the upper floors, dusting and tidying the shelves. All in all, there were more books in the library, Gwen felt sure, than she had seen in the entirety of her life outside it.
A dozen saffron-robed monks were seated at the tables, copying volumes by hand, while younger initiates carried paper, sprinkled sand over pages to dry the still wet ink, and performed any number of other tasks to support the effort. Gentle music drifted through the air from a pair of monks playing wooden flutes in elegantly interwoven melodies. Gwen stared for several silent seconds, and then realized that she was attempting to calculate the approximate value of the books, based solely upon their materials. The paper for each book was representative of more wood than its volume would suggest. House Lancaster had a library of several hundred volumes, but it was one of the wealthiest houses in all of Spire Albion. Havel Mornings Academy had nearly 1,000 volumes collected over 2 centuries, some of them quite old and valuable. But this place? The great library could scarcely have been more costly in a purely monetary sense if its walls and floors had been coated with gold. But that was, she supposed, in keeping with the rest of Havel Landing. Entire buildings had been made of wood here, in their mad division of their working space. She had known the local economy was vigorous, but she'd had no idea that the level of commerce taking place here dwarfed that of Havel Mornings itself. All that construction would have required milling of the wood, resulting in mountains of sawdust. Perhaps that had been the source of raw materials for the paper in the volumes before her. That might have lowered the price, but all the same, the books represented a genuine fortune amongst a group of men and women who were known for their pathological avoidance of excess or material gain. It also went a great way toward explaining why the monks so strongly discouraged casual visits to the temple, she supposed. Her own family's vatteries weren't precisely open to the public either.
"Oh,"
Folly breathed out loud. The oddly dressed girl was staring at the library with round eyes.
"Oh, is that—"
"Oh, yes," Master Ferris replied.
"I've never, never felt this in our library, Master."
"Felt what?"
Ferris asked. His voice was gentle, but his eyes, thought Gwen, were rather sharp. Folly was silent for a moment before she said,
"I'm not sure."
"Think on it," Ferris suggested.
He turned to Brother Vincent and asked,
"Might she remain here, quietly, while we take tea, brother? I give you my word that she will give you no offence."
Brother Vincent bowed at the waist, then he stepped aside and murmured something to one of the apprentices before moving back toward the group.
"Miss, please do not touch any of the volumes without consulting one of my order."
Folly tensed when the monk spoke to her, and cradled her jar of little crystals close to her chin.
"Oh, he spoke to me. Ought I tell him that I understand? No, of course not. He knows now, because I asked you about it."
"There," Master Ferris said with a pleased smile. "Now, about that tea?"
Brother Vincent studied the etherealist's apprentice for a speculative moment, then smiled at Master Ferris and said,
"This way."
The monk led them to a modest dining hall, featuring low, round tables made of copper-clad iron, surrounded by sturdy cushions instead of chairs. Gwen was unsure of the dignity of such novel seating, but she managed to sit down upon one of the cushions with what she felt sure was acceptable grace, and within moments they were sipping at cups of hot, excellent tea, sweetened with scandalous portions of honey. Raoul had a small bowl of his own. The cat wasn't satisfied until Bridget had spooned twice as much honey as anyone else had into it. Once they had all sipped, or lapped, Brother Vincent nodded and turned to Benedict, who sat at his right.
"Very well, then. Tell me."
Benedict made a round of introductions,
and gave a concise account of the events of the past days, including the purpose of their own visit to Landing.
"In short," he said, "we need a place to stay that is free of any undue influence of the guilds. It was my hope that the Walker could be convinced to allow us to operate from here, brother. It's the most secure place we could ask for."
"Walker?"
Gwen asked.
"The foremost brother or sister at the temple," Brother Vincent said, smiling.
He turned back to Benedict and shook his bald head.
"I'm sorry, son.
The laws of our order are precisely that. The waste temples do not take sides in political disputes of any kind."
"But this is your home," Gwen blurted. "If the Aurorans conquer Albion, they conquer you along with it."
"The Temple of the Way in Spire Aurora operates quite peacefully," Brother Vincent said in a mild tone.
"We would deeply regret the loss of life that such a conquest would necessitate. We would help the wounded and the bereft in any way that we could. We would peaceably protest any inhumanity perpetrated by either side, and accept the consequences of that protest. But we are neither soldiers nor warriors here, Miss Lancaster. That is not our path."
"I don't remember asking you to fight anyone for me, Brother Vincent," Gwendolyn replied. "I have recently discovered that I have something of a knack for it."
"Should we permit you to use the temple as the base of your inquisition, it would create the impression of partisanship with the Spyrarch. We deeply respect his authority and his restraint, but the purpose of our temple is to serve all humanity, not merely the inhabitants of one spire." Benedict smiled without much humour.
"Which is the answer I expected you to give, brother. Perhaps you have a suggestion as to where we might stay in relative safety. It's been a while since I was last here, and even then I didn't know the Habel as well as the Order does."
Brother Vincent took a long, slow sip of his tea. His eyes narrowed in thought.
"If you're searching for an entirely honourable proprietor in this Habel, I hope you brought considerable supplies to sustain you."
He returned Benedict's faint smile with one of his own.
"It's all the money, I think. It does strange things to some people."
"Surely some must be better than others," Benedict said.
"Some certainly appear to be," Vincent replied. "Whether the truth matches the appearance is another matter. I have often heard it said that anything in Landing has a price, especially loyalty."
Gwendolyn lowered her cup and stated,
"We don't need an honourable innkeeper, Benny."
Her cousin blinked at her.
"We don't?"
"Not at all. We simply need one who sells his loyalty with adequate integrity."
She turned to Brother Vincent.
"Is there an innkeeper who, when bought, remains bought?"
The monk raised his eyebrows.
"A mercenary innkeep?"
"It is the quickest way, and we are in something of a hurry," Gwen said.
Vincent seemed to muse over that for a moment before saying,
"Giving you even so little a thing as our advice strains the neutrality the Order has worked hard to cultivate."
"What if we are not asking Brother Vincent?" Gwen said. "Suppose we ask my cousin's old teacher, Vincent, for a recommendation."
"Sophistry," the monk said. "And threadbare at that."
"We're simply having conversation over tea," Gwendolyn pointed out firmly. "It isn't as though the Spyrarch has written requesting your aid."
Brother Vincent pursed his lips.
"I must carefully consider the impact my actions might have on the Order and other followers of the Way."
"While you're at it," Gwen said, "perhaps you should consider the impact your lack of action might have on the Wayists of Spire Albion, along with all of their neighbours. Surely they are included in the roles of the humanity you say you wish to serve."
Brother Vincent blinked several times. Then he said in a mild tone,
"You don't take hints terribly well, do you, Miss Lancaster?"
Perhaps I'm choosing not to hear them,
Gwen replied in a honeyed tone. Something that looked suspiciously like a newborn smile suddenly danced in the monk's eyes. Gwendolyn smiled brightly back at him. Chapter 27 Spire Albion, Habble Landing, The Black Horse Inn. Bridget walked along a bit behind Benedict, whose eyes constantly scanned the streets around them as they walked from the temple to the inn Brother Vincent had named. She really shouldn't have been chattering at him on the way there. After all, it was his duty to watch for danger and protect Master Ferris from any attack. How could he do that effectively while she was hanging all over him?
"What did you discover, Folly?"
Master Ferris was saying to his apprentice. The oddly dressed girl frowned for half a minute before she spoke.
"Frozen souls."
"Ah," Ferris said, raising a finger. "Yes, near enough. Well done, child."
Folly beamed and hugged her jar of crystals to her chest.
"But why haven't I ever felt anything like that in our study?" "It is primarily a matter of density," Ferris replied. "One needs more than a handful of trees to see a forest."
Folly frowned at that.
"It seemed as if they spoke to one another." "Nothing quite so complex as that, I think," the etherealist said. "Some sort of communion, though, definitely."
Bridget cleared her throat and said tentatively,
"Excuse me, Master Ferris."
The etherealist and his apprentice turned their eyes to her.
"Yes?"
he asked.
"I do not mean to intrude, but what are you talking about?"
"Books, my dear," Ferris replied. "Books."
Bridget blinked once.
"Books do not have souls, sir."
"Those who write them do,"
Ferris said.
"They leave bits and pieces behind them when they lay down the words, some scraps and smears of their essential nature." He sniffed. "Most untidy, really. But assemble enough scraps, and one might have something approaching a whole."
"You believe that the library has a soul?"
Bridget said carefully.
"I do not believe it, young lady,"
Ferris said rather stiffly.
"I know it."
"I see," Bridget said. "Thank you for answering my question."
"You are welcome."
They kept going, following Benedict, and eventually came to the inn on a well-travelled portion of the streets leading to the gallery outside the shipyard. A sign hanging outside featured, as many of them did, the drawing of a fantastic animal that supposedly existed long ago. Most of the inns in Habble Morning were so decorated, Bridget knew. The lettering beneath proclaimed the building to be the Black Horse Inn. They went in and found the usual for such a place, a common room where food and drink were served, in essence a small pub or restaurant. The ceiling was really quite low. Benedict had to duck his head a little to avoid bumping it against the heavy beams supporting the second floor. The air was thick and smoky, too. Several men and women sitting huddled at the tables were holding pipes that smouldered with whatever weed they burned within them, which was, strictly speaking, against the guidelines laid out by the merciful builders in the High Manual. Apparently, they had viewed smoking as a serious sin. But then, Habble Landing did have something of a reputation as a place of disinclination to piety. It was, after all, the home Habble of the Wayest Temple, and had only a few small chapels to God in heaven. Here, the guiding principle was the interest of business, and apparently at the Black Horse Inn, business was excellent. There were 70 people at least crowded into the common room, occupying every table. 2 women were weaving as rapidly as they could through the room, carrying food and drink to the tables, and taking away empty plates and cups.
Back in the kitchen, dishes rattled and voices spoke loudly, but without heat, evidence of a business operating at its full, focused speed.
A moment, ladies and gentlemen, called a round-cheeked man in a rather plainly made jacket of silvery grey raw ether silk. Only after he'd said that did he take a look at them. Bridget saw his bright, rather closely set eyes take in Gwendolyn and Ferris's